Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In the spirit of reconciliation, the Swapcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respect to the elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
We're talking again
about body swapping. Two boys, two boys, two white.
And back again.
Welcome to the Swapcast podcast, the world's only podcast dedicated to body swap movies. I'm your host, Paul Mitzi. Lucy and Brendan are both taking a break this week, but I have an extra special treat because joining me today is an absolute icon, the star of the body swap classic 18 Again, as well as some truly iconic projects such as The Delinquents, Diagnosis Murder, Ferris Bueller, and so much more. Welcome to the show, Charlie Schlotter.
Paul, thank you very much, sir. Wow, that's a crazy nice introduction. I don't know if I deserve that. But thank you.
Definitely do. Thanks so much for making the time to be in our show. How's life in LA right now?
It's good. You know, everybody complains about something, but I'm not gonna. I have to say, just, you know, great weather. It's awesome. Yeah, everybody's happy, healthy, no COVID on this side of the globe, and you know, in our family, and we're all good. We're all good.
I'm definitely jealous of the weather because it is freezing in Adelaide right now.
Yeah, but that's just now. You guys normally have it pretty good.
Oh, yeah. We've come off a run of like 30-degree weather for 4 months, but yeah.
Yeah.
I still can complain.
Yeah.
All right. So I would love to start with 18 Again.
Sure.
Which was the 1988 comedy starring yourself, George Burns, Paulie Shore, and Red Buttons, where your character swaps bodies with his grandfather on his 81st birthday. This was your second feature film. So how did you become attached to that?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. How did I get attached? I had just completed work on my first movie ever. It was called Bright Lights, Big City with Michael J. Fox. And I played his younger brother in that. And that came about just because I was pretty much doing a play in upstate New York, and a casting director had seen me in it and said, gosh, you know, I think you'd be really great for this thing that they're casting right now called Bright Lights, Big City. And it's funny, I had read the book by Jay McInerney, and I said, well, what part? And they said, for the lead's brother, the brother. And I go, oh, I said, well, in the book, you know, they describe the brother as like this big strapping lad who, I think he's described as he fills a door frame or a door, whatever. And I thought, you know, I'm not that guy. I'm kind of a Shetland guy. And she said, well, the lead is Michael J. Fox. You'd be playing his brother. So I said, oh, that sounds doable. So, yeah, I auditioned for it, and I ended up getting it like that day because they had just, they were recasting everybody. They had a new director, knew this, knew that. And I guess they were just kind of under the gun to move quickly. And I guess I was maybe the shortest white guy who walked in there to play his brother. And so I got the part. And then I kind of went back after we shot. I went back to Ithaca, New York, where I was going to school. And it was still in the summer. So I went back and I did a production of Tartuffe. And while I was doing that, I got a call from my new agent now, because now I'm all fancy. I'm strapped. I got agents and all that stuff. And they said, would you like to come and, you know, into New York, you know, about a 4-hour drive. Would you like to come down and audition for this thing called 18 Again with George Burns? I said, oh, my God. Yeah, of course. So as soon as I was done, as soon as the play was wrapped, I drove down to New York and they put me on video, because it was being cast in L.A. But here's the reason I even got that call was because a woman, the casting director, her name is Melissa Scoff. She apparently they had been looking for a long time for this part. And, you know, back then, casting directors didn't just go online and find people. They went to clubs. They went to plays. They went to things and they would discover people. But so just one word of mouth led to another. And she heard about there's this new kid who's doing this Michael J. Fox thing. Well, who's he? Send me some. Anyway, they sent her some tape on me that they had like dailies or whatever from Bright Lights, Big City. So she looked at that and said, oh, okay, this guy looks like he could be the guy. And because of that, I got the call, like I said, to audition in New York. And so I did my little thing. And I think it was like 2 days later, I was on a plane to New York to meet with the producer, Walter Koblenz, and to meet with Paul Flaherty, the director, who's just the nicest human being on the planet. So I went in there and I did my little shtick, my little cigar thing and whatever. And they basically said, we want you to be in this movie. I said, okay. And that was it. I went back. I collected a couple of things. And I think like a couple weeks later, I moved out to L.A., not permanently, but just came out for the shoot, which took about 3 months or so. So that's kind of how that thing happened, just the process.
So in that casting process, was there a lot of talk about how similar you were to George Burns? Like, were they trying to get someone that kind of looked like him at your age?
Or, I think they, because it wasn't so much like an impersonation, you know, I think they just wanted somebody who embodied George. It's funny, though, the director will tell me or had told me, he goes, you know, it wasn't because of how you performed George that got you this part. It's everything else. So I go, oh my God, is that good or bad? I think it was good. And then, you know, and then we just kind of worked on it. You know, and in so much as embodying George, it's funny, my real grandfather was from the same area of New York when he grew up. He was from the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And whenever I couldn't really draw upon, like, oh, I wonder what George Burns would do in this situation, I just say, what would my grandfather do? How would he behave? What would his posturing be? And so I just kind of drew on that, for physicality, for the sound of things, because he did. He was very much like George, just this very close to the vest, just a great straight man, and very witty and funny. So that's where I really drew a lot from, because I knew who George Burns was, obviously, because this is back in 1988. And he was, at that time, he was a living legend. Everybody alive knew who George Burns was. If you knew who Santa Claus was, you knew who George Burns was. And I had never met him. But then it was so funny when I finally did meet him. They're walking me down this hallway. We're in Beverly Hills going into his office, and his manager's walking us down the hallway. And you could smell the cigars, like, from the second you walk in, which is like the first indication, hey, George is near. And then you go down this little skinny hallway into this room, which is his office, his hangout, his little man cave. And he's sitting up high on this director chair with a cigar, drinking tea out of a mug. And on the mug, it said God. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. And so just from there, you know, he goes, is that the kid? And they go, yeah. He goes, I'll take him. And he was just great. He was just I can't even tell you. It was just, you were in awe the whole time you were with him. And so was everybody involved in the project. It was, everybody knew how special it was, which doesn't happen ever.
Like, I think watching the film, you can really, I think a lot of what makes it work is your embodiment of George Burns. And like, how much of that was you like following him around and observing him? Like, did you get a lot of time with George Burns, like in the pre-production stage?
No. And if I did, it was like, we would go to dinner. George did not rehearse with you. You had like no practice. He came to the set with his lines in the noodle. He knew everything. He didn't say like, oh, I'm the director, I'm going to go from here to here to here. Because you've always, you hear stories about those guys. All right, the camera's going to follow me. No, he was so respectful of the director and the process and whose film, you know, he knew whose film it was. And that's really the only time I worked with him. And yeah, when you are sitting at lunch together, I'm observing him a little bit. I think like really the only tip he gave me as to how to be him was to switch the cigar from my right hand to my left. And I said, "Oh, are you left-handed?" And he said, "No, I'm right-handed." And I said, "Oh, why do you smoke with your left hand?" He said, "Well, this way, when I was doing vaudeville, if I ever had to adjust the microphone, I would have my hand free to move things." And that's it. So I just had to kind of get used to smoking with the left hand. And that was about it.
So were you actually smoking cigars throughout the whole film? Like, were you really taking it in?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, I don't know if you've ever had a cigar, but, you know, you don't like really take it deep into your lungs. You just kind of puff it and blow it. And even it's so funny because even George Burns, you know, they say, oh, he'd smoke 20 cigars a day. He probably just had 20 of them burning all day and he would just puff on a punchline for something. That's all, like, to him, that's all that cigar was just a, you know, the emphasis of a joke. But he wasn't like, you know, a hardcore smoker. And another interesting fact is this. So many fans would send him cigars from across the globe and like, you know, $100, $200 cigars because they exist. Yeah. And people would send them. He would basically just give them away or just throw them away because he only smoked Dutch Masters, Queens, which is like equivalent back then to like a 25-cent cigar. And he liked those because you didn't have to keep relighting them. He said, "Nah, the cheaper cigars, they keep burning." Because for his act, he didn't want to have to stop and light and do all that messy stuff. He just wanted to stand there, tell jokes, puff, move on.
So is that what you were also smoking in the film then?
Oh, yeah, totally. That's, you know, you go to craft service, you know, there's Pop-Tarts, Fruit Loops, apples, and a bunch of cigars for anybody who wants cigars. So everyone, I mean, it was like a smoke fest. It was crazy.
Did the film kind of give you the taste for them? Is that something that's still in your life now?
It isn't anymore. Every now and then I will. But, you know, it's funny, like, I did continue to smoke them. But then it became like the early 90s and everyone was smoking cigars. And I thought, oh, I don't want to be like everybody. It was so trendy. Like all of a sudden it became trendy for like these young guys to start, you know, cause I think Cigar Aficionado had just come out and blah, blah, blah. And all these fancy humidors. And then there's Schwarzenegger smoking cigars. And I just thought, nah, I'm kind of done with this, but you know, at a birthday, they're the birth of someone or a wedding, I'm going to light up.
So George Burns wasn't the only like iconic actor in this film. There was also Red Buttons.
And yeah.
I think a moment that really stands out in the film for me is when you guys sing Light of the Silvery Moon together.
Yeah.
Was that a really special moment filming it, or did you feel like it was at the time?
Oh, you know, I knew it was at the time. It's so funny. Like, I come from a family that, you know, we're just a blue collar family who just really loved to be entertained. And, you know, Red Buttons was one of those guys to us. He was one of those comics that we loved and we just found so much joy from. And beyond my dad, you know, my grandfather, who was born in 1920, he was a big fan of vaudeville. So, you know, of course, he knew who George was and he knew who Red was. And so when I got to just kind of do like that little shuffle with Red Buttons, it was, you know, I just got to kind of firsthand just kind of get into a time machine, I guess, and go back and do that kind of fun stuff. So I did. I knew how great it was. I know now even more how great it was. I wish I knew back then, you know, I wish I had more appreciation. I know that I appreciated it. And I know like those moments, I thought, oh my God, this is like 50 years of vaudeville history that I'm dancing with or whatever. But now, like in hindsight, I think, gosh, that was like a really great thing that happened to me. But again, Paul, I was really appreciative even at those moments. I knew it. I never took one of those moments for granted.
I think a lot of your early career seems to be a bit of a time machine towards that era. Like even The Delinquents and even your first movie, like they were all kind of geared towards this 50s and earlier kind of time frame.
Yeah. So
did your, I guess your grandfather and your father really react to that?
I don't know so much. I think they were always just more about like, you know, the project, the music, the whatever was going on in it. I don't think we ever sat back and said, oh, this is kind of an interesting thing. Because I did kind of do a mix of contemporary, but you're right. I did like some period stuff, like even the Heartbreak Hotel that took place in the early 70s. And it was just, I don't know. You just kind of, I really don't think I've thought about that, to be honest with you. It was just, you kind of went from one film to the next and you tried not to do the same thing twice in a row, at least, you know, not until later on. But yeah, you just try to kind of do things that were interesting to you.
So in the film, your character does quite a bit of athletics. Is that something that comes naturally to you, or did you have to do a lot of training and preparation for those scenes? Because you do seem like naturally gifted in that when you watch the film, but I don't know how much of that is movie magic or not.
Oh, no, thanks. I did. I played sports in school always until, you know, everyone kind of grew except me. And then I kind of got into theater and did that. But yeah, it was a lot of running, a lot of jumping. And I think, you know, more than anything, your adrenaline takes over when skill is lacking. Adrenaline just says, oh, I'll do this for you. But they did. I actually had because I came out to LA about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks before we started filming. And during those weeks, I had a track trainer, which I thought was like the craziest thing I had ever heard of. I said, don't you just like run in a circle? And they're like, no, there's a skill to it. And, you know, I seriously thought, oh, you run a mile, you just do four laps and you're done. But no, it was all about how to have your fingers, how to blow. It was, oh my gosh, this is like real stuff. So anyway, I did. I had trainers for all that stuff. I don't know if you get to see me doing the pole vault, but that's actually me not making it over. But I will tell you, that pole is like 1,000 pounds. It's the heaviest damn thing. And to run with that and then to get it in the whatever they call that thing, that was rough. But they did have like, they had a guy there, you know, a real pole vaulter, Olympic style, who actually got over like every time. And then they said, why don't you try it, Charlie? You know, and that's what they ended up with, you know.
Because like when you're shooting the track scenes, like I'm assuming they don't just do it once. Like how long are you running for in a day of shooting that?
Oh, it was long. I mean, you probably, you know, the track stuff, we were out at that track for probably like 3 days just doing stuff. And one of the days probably ran at least 10 miles, 12 miles. You know, it's funny. I love Tony Stark, Anthony Stark, the actor who plays the heavy. Is Russ Deacon? Was that his name? Russ. I think it was Russ.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, yeah, he's such a good heavy, such a good bad guy. And anyway, in the final scene of the movie, and I'm sure by now this isn't a spoiler alert, I'm supposed to win the race. Yeah. We did about 5 takes prior to me winning where he kept winning. You know, because I'm supposed to win by like a hair. So it was like really, and we had to like do it from a quarter mile out. But at that point in the race, we're like, we're sprinting. We're like really giving it everything we have. And after like the 4th one or 5th one, I said, Tony, you got to read the freaking script, man. I win this race. And he's like, I know. I'm sorry. But yeah. So that was really rough. But yeah, for, you know, a lot of it was, you just kind of followed the car, running after the car. And then the fall, I remember I fell in that thing and they wanted me to trip, but I really did. Like I really got my cleat stuck in the clay and I think you could actually see me saying, oh fuck, or oh shit, or something really. And I was like, oh my, no, that, cause it really, it hurt my leg. But anyway, yeah, you know, you can't complain about that though. You just get out there and run. You're 20 years old, 21 years old, run.
Yeah, you do seem like, watching some of the stuff from this era, you do seem like someone that was quite willing to do your own stunts and really be physical in your films. Like, I was wondering, because it's kind of in shadow, but in The Delinquents, there's a sequence where you and Kylie are like looking over a barrier, and then your character does a flip and then runs down this really steep hill. And I'm like, it looks like that was really you, but
That wasn't me. That's a stunt guy. But I will tell you this. Here's something. There's a scene where Brownie Hansen crawls up this pole at a movie theater and removes a letter or something like that. Anyway,
the Marlon Brando's name off of the top of the
Yeah. So we had a stunt guy. I can't remember his name. I'm so sorry for that. I apologize if he's watching. But great guy, very similar to me. And anyway, they film him doing the thing. He shimmies up there, blah blah blah, lands like a cat, takes off the letter, does whatever he does. And they go, "Charlie, if you want to take a shot at it?" I go, "Yeah, sure." So I go and I do almost the same thing. It probably didn't look as great, but I did it, and they didn't use it. I just thought, why did you use his? They go, "Well, just because his looked a lot better." And I said, my character doesn't have to be great at that, you know, anyway. But I always, whenever there is a stunt and, you know, it seems relatively safe, you know, you try it. You just do it like within character, whether it's hopping a fence or whatever. Try to do as much as you can. I think now that I'm older, it's probably like, yeah, let the kid do it. You know, I'm too tired. I'm tired.
So Paulie Shore is in 18 again, and he actually delivers quite like a sweet and restrained performance from, I guess, what people are used to, especially to what his filmography became in the 90s.
Yeah.
So what do you think is closer to his actual personality, the character he played in this film or the crazy characters he started playing afterwards?
I'll preface this whole thing by saying I haven't seen a lot of the things that he's done after it. You know, I just haven't. I will say this. I think Paulie's performance in the movie is really good. And like you said, a lot of it is really just restrained. It's understated. And I credit that to Paulie, naturally, but also our director, too, who really knew how to pull Paulie in. And, you know, there was a lot of scenes in there that Paulie and I did that didn't make it, just because, you know, scenes, just if it doesn't move the movie forward, that's the first step that's lost. You know what I mean? Regardless of how good the scene is, you know, but if you have like a 5-minute scene of Paulie and I eating lettuce and it's really funny, but it doesn't mean anything, you lose it. Anyway, we had done, Paulie and I did a lot of really like funny scenes that never made it to the movie, but that were so like tucked under, that were really, I think, really good. And I do think, like, Paulie was the first guy I was hanging out with when I came to LA. So we became really great friends during the shoot of 18 Again, and we did so many things together and used to hang out at the Comedy Store all the time. So we always got into a little bit of mischief, like healthy mischief, good stuff. And he was a very, very sweet guy. I really, really liked Paulie. And then I went away for a while and came back in town like a year or so later, after I kind of had to move to LA, and we kind of had a friendship, but I guess we just kind of went different ways, and whether it be careers or whatever, we just kind of, like I said, went a different way. I haven't seen Paulie in forever. I have a feeling if I did see him right now, it would be just hugs and hugs. And it would be so great to see him. You know, when you're 50 something years old, you know, it's just kind of nice to have those touchstones to go back and say, "Oh my God, Paul, look at you," you know? Yeah. So, but no, he was, I think that personality that you see was very close to him. This other, the weasel buddy, that I think was just a persona that he created for comedy. And, you know, at some point it paid off. You know, he made those, not the weasel movies, but I don't know, what were they called?
Like he did Jam. like, he did like Jury Duty and Biodome and all those kind of like,
yeah. And there was an army movie too, wasn't there? It was,
In the army all that now,
like that fish out of water stuff. But you know,
So one thing we kind of picked up on in our review of the film is that we thought his character maybe had a bit of a crush on your character. There was maybe unrequited love there. Was that something intended, or is that just something we just picked up on?
I think it's something that probably people look at now as something like that, because there's more of that type of adoration in films, that, you know, a guy loving another guy in that romantic way. Back then, in 1987, when we were shooting the movie, there was no undertone or overtone. It was just a guy who really loved this other guy as a brother, you know, and that's kind of how it was. I think sometimes when you had a character that was just so open, like, you know, Barrett was his name, you know, you could interpret that as, oh, I bet he's gay for David Watson. But it wasn't. It was just like a, dude, I love you, man, and I love your art, and I'm here for you.
Yeah.
So, no,
which
I don't...
is lovely as well.
Yeah.
I mean, like, interpretation is good.
It is.
I was just wondering, like, when you guys were shooting, if there was any kind of intention for that.
But no, never.
Like, either interpretation works.
Nah, absolutely not. And because I could tell you, I know for a fact it wasn't Paulie's intention. I could tell you it was never the director's intention for that. And it was never the writer. It was never like a written thing that the directors felt like, you know, and Jonathan Prince, you know, who wrote it. It was just he in the original script, he was like this real nerdy guy, Barrett, you know, so it was more of a nerdy open thing. But then, you know, Paulie came in with his look and his whatever, so maybe that coupled with that attitude would lean its way to thinking he had, you know, homosexual tendencies and whatever. But now that just and whether, you know, if people want to listen, movies are out there for people to interpret how they want. It really doesn't matter. I could tell you it wasn't the intent. You know, again, you could write a song about whatever, and maybe that's not the intent, but if people are drawn to it for that reason, then so be it. That, you know, whatever is going to give someone pleasure from watching that, they're 100%, you know, allowed to have all that feeling and those thoughts. I think that's great.
So how do you feel 18 Again holds up in 2022? Like, when I purchased this film, it actually came on a double DVD set with Soul Man, which was made a few years before 18 Again.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, that might be one of the most offensive major studio films ever made.
That could be a rough one, yeah.
So how do you think it stacks between, like, against a lot of the other, like, 80s teen comedies that came out?
I haven't seen 18 Again in quite some time. I think the last time I saw some of it was when I think my kids were watching it for some reason, and they really don't like to see anything I'm in. You know, it's just weird to them. It's like, no, you're a dad. You're part of the furniture. You don't have a life. but I think some of it felt a little dated, but I tend to think that it probably would hold up in the sense that it's such a universal theme. And you've probably seen it more recently than I have, but I don't think there's anything that was offensive at all. You know what I mean? And if anything was offensive, it was maybe George Burns's, you know, kind of 1920s chauvinistic whatever, but you know what I mean? It was all, everything was very playful, and nothing was ever done in harm or in spite or with malintent, you know? And I just know that when we showed up to the set, it was like, there was so much love in everybody's hearts, and everybody just felt really good about this nice collaboration. If anybody, you know, was hurt in its wake, you know, I guess that's bad, but I don't think anybody ever was. I mean, this is a movie that they would show like on Mother's Day and Easter. And, you know what I mean? Yeah. Back in the 90s when cable was by, it was just, it was all the time. It was like on all those holidays.
Yeah. Like, I think I have obviously watched it a couple of times recently. And I don't think it is offensive. Obviously, yes, George Burns' character is a bit of a chauvinist, but I don't think the film ever takes it to that level where it's uncomfortable to watch. And
a representation of that time and that culture. Yeah. And what makes it funny is that you're taking that old-timey attitude and switching it with a kid who is this progressive artist in 1987 in college. You know what I mean? So it was kind of like how Tootsie originally meant to be, you know, learning about women from the inside, and the same thing as learning about these new kids today from the inside. And you know what I mean? And really just coming to terms with what you've done wrong in your life and what you could do better in your life.
Yeah. And even like, your love interest in the film, she has those interactions with her professor, which felt very relevant a lot of the conversations that happen now.
I was going to say that's not dated. That's like still happening as we speak.
Yeah. So, I think it definitely holds up.
Oh, well, good.
So between 1987 and 1988, we had Like Father, Like Son release on October 87. Vice Versa came out in March 1988. Then 18 Again came out in April 1988. And then finally Big came out in November 1988. Right. So why do you think there was suddenly such an obsession in Hollywood with body swap movies? And did the casts of these movies have any kind of rivalry with each other? Any punch-ups with Kirk Cameron or Fred Savage?
No, in fact, this was at a time also when, you know, we didn't have social media. You didn't know what everybody was up to every minute of the day. I think nowadays, if you had four movies that were either pre-production, post-production that had the same vibe, you know, we would know about it. I truly don't think, I know we weren't in a rush to film anything, to finish anything before another movie happened. You know, it's funny. I know this is a show about the soul swapping thing, but it seems like there were probably more films about Vietnam within that year span than there were about soul switching. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think, you know, everything is kind of secular, or it just kind of comes and goes, ebbs and flows. But you're right. That was, it was just kind of odd that like four very similar things happened at the same time. So I couldn't tell you. And I don't think like Father, Like Son people could tell you. I know, you know, Kirk Cameron and I both had sons on the same club soccer team. And it was kind of funny. And we talked about both being in like these soul switching movies. And, you know, like, yeah, he didn't know we were making one and we didn't know he was making one. And it just was what it was. You know what I mean? But again, it's a theme, as you know, going back to whenever, that it's kind of a tried and true theme, you know, and if it's done right, why not? You know, it's not like you're reinventing the wheel, but you're presenting a different type of wheel that's really kind of cool. So, you know, if you're into that genre, why not? You know what I mean? It's not going to stop you from watching Freaky Friday. It's like, okay, you know, and sometimes you want to see like, God, I wonder how do they approach waking up in a new body? You know, because it is, it's a lifelong thing that we always say to ourselves. If we could walk a shoe in some walk a mile in someone else's shoes, you want to know, especially whether it means going back 50 years in time or ahead 50, whatever. You know, so I don't know. People just, well, you know, you have fans of the show who you know, like the genre. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. Doing the show, we have discovered that, like, because we kind of started it. Just we chose a subject and ran with it, but then doing it, we've discovered there are actual people that are devoted to this subgenre of film and storytelling and are really dedicated to it.
All right, Paul, I think you should have a convention in Adelaide a soul switching convention, and I'll help you get like Fred Savage. We'll get, you know, Kirk Cameron out there. We'll get Jodie Foster from, we'll get, you know, Lindsay Lohan. We'll get her, and we'll get all these people, and we'll just, you know, switch the shit out of each other. How's that?
That sounds amazing.
I'll look into it. I'll see if Pauly Shore's around, you know.
So I would like to ask you about some of the other projects, if that's okay.
Sure.
So in 1989, you shot an Australian film, The Delinquents, opposite Kylie Minogue, a 1950s set drama about star-crossed lovers. How did you find yourself part of an Australian production?
I had done a few movies already, and I was with an agency. I was with this company called CAA, and a script came across their desk, and a Village Road Show, and the director and whatever had just basically called and asked if I was interested in doing this film. It was just a straight out offer. I didn't audition or anything. And I think they were at that time looking for, you know, someone who was doing well, you know, in films, who wasn't necessarily, who wasn't terribly famous, but just someone who they could kind of, you know, claim and cultivate, and, you know, young enough that I would still be a fresh face to someone without being a tired old 20-year-old. And so, like I said, I got the part. It was interesting because, the original script, I was Australian, and then they basically, it was like the Australian consulate or something, in order to get a work visa permit there, they said, well, and listen, rightfully so, they said, we don't want to have an American come to our country and take the job from an Australian. Why can't you find an Australian actor to play Brownie Hansen? So they said, okay, he's American now. And so and it's so funny because that was like 3 weeks, I think, after being offered the role, and me accepting it. I had just spun on my heels, and I found a dialect coach. And I started, you know, working on an Australian dialect. You know, this, we tried to like, narrow it down. I think we couldn't really find like what a true Bundaberg accent would have been, but we did find, you know, we worked on like what Brisbane would be, some city sort of close to that area. And so we were working on that for a few weeks until we got the call saying, nah, flag on the play, you're just going to be American. I was like, okay.
So how good did your Australian accent get then?
I don't know. I don't think it was that great. You know, it might have been okay. Like I feel more comfortable now because now I do like tons of voiceovers and cartoons and stuff like that. So if I have to be Australian, I don't mind. It's good enough for a cartoon. I do remember why does it all have to be so nicely? You know,
that's not too bad.
And so, but that was like the hardest thing working, because I think just naturally I was kind of nasally. I was like, I don't want to like, and it didn't sound attractive at all. I'm like, you know, this is a love story. I'm not supposed to sound like whatever, like Crocodile Dundee. But anyway, I'd give myself conservatively, I'd give myself like a C+ for the effort.
Yeah. Well, being an Australian film, I can tell you that when Americans do Australian accent in our movies, we are like super critical. So you probably dodged a bullet there.
Oh yeah, because even there was the guy who played Mavis's boyfriend or something. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be from somewhere. I don't know if it was from Liverpool. I don't know, were they British in the movie?
Yeah, he was, because he sounds like one of the Beatles.
And people gave him so much shit, like, what is that accent? I was like, wow, I thought it sounded really good to me. But Lyle, that was his name, Lyle. Lyle and Mavis were the two characters. Yeah. I thought he sounded great, but man, you guys were giving him shit. I will say, on the other side of the token, you guys, when you come here to the States, it's like, oh my God, can every Australian sound like American with ease? It sounds so easy to you guys. And I'm like always shocked. I keep going, oh my God, that guy's Australian. I thought he was from New York or whatever. I'll tell you know who would have gotten the role of Brownie?
I heard, was it Ben Mendelsohn?
Yes. Who I didn't even know was Australian, because I didn't even know who he was until I was watching something, Blood something. I don't know. It was a series on Netflix.
Yeah. No, I do. Blood? I know the one you're talking about. Yeah. It wasn't True Blood. But I know the one you're talking about. Yeah.
Had blood in the title. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's so good. I mean, he's just amazing. Then so I said, yeah, you know. And then I had read an article. I was like, get out. That guy was going to be Brownie Hansen if I didn't do it.
So obviously, Kylie Minogue's your co-star in this film, and she's like an Australian icon. And even back then, she was already like a household name thanks to her TV and music. Did you have any idea how huge she was when you shot the film?
No, I never heard of her. And my agents didn't hear of her either. There's like, it's like Kylie Minogue. I said, who's he? Because even the name Kylie was not even a name that you would hear in the States, like ever. Go back in history. I don't think there was a Kylie until like Kylie Jenner. And that's for real. So no, I had no idea who she was. And, you know, yeah, none. Which maybe made it better. You know what I mean? Sometimes, because, you know, you just show up and it's a, you know, level playing field. So, but she was great to work with.
And did you guys get along outside of the shooting or?
Yeah, I think so. You know, she always had a full plate, always had to be here, be there and do stuff. And, you know, honestly, we probably didn't hang around together that much just because, like I said, she always was, you know, winging off to somewhere to be with Jason, whoever, and this and that. And just, you know, there were just a lot of demands, I guess, on her at that time. So, you know, I'm usually a guy who hangs out with the crew. Like, that's who I end up being friends with, the gaffers, the best boy, the whoever. But no, I didn't really hang. I tried to get in touch with Kylie not that long ago and to no avail. You know, I called a lot of her people. I was doing this thing for the Leukemia Lymphoma Society. I was raising money, and for which I raised a ton of money for these people. And anyway, I tried to reach out to Kylie because I know she's also a cancer survivor like myself. Mm-hmm. And I never got a response.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I'm still not big enough.
I was watching some videos of the press tour of that film, and she seemed to be getting a lot of slack for like attempting like an edgier role, and the fact that the film had nudity and sex scenes, which like the Australian audiences weren't used to in regards to her. And it almost seemed like in some of the interviews that she seemed very attacked. Like, was that genuine? Like, was she feeling that pressure when she was doing the press for that film?
You know, I was a 22-year-old guy. I wasn't very tuned into her pressures. You know, I was just a single guy loose in Australia. So, you know, you'd have to ask her what was going on in her head at that time. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I never saw the Neighbor show, so I don't know like what her image was, except like, you know, she would tell me sometimes, and, you know, I guess I, you know, acted like I care. I don't know. It just, it didn't, you know, it's just, okay, well, we're here, we're just making a movie. And, you know, if you look at that movie now, not a lot of edge to it, you know?
Yeah.
Comparatively to what you see young actresses and actors having to do today, I feel bad. You know what I mean? Not that I feel bad, but it's just, it's a different game. It's almost like it's almost required of a young actress to be naked at some point. And even actors, it's like total full frontal nudity. And there's no, I don't know. I don't know if there's just no shame, or there's so much gratuitous sex. Yeah. And it's just, you know, it is offensive. I find a lot of it, like, you know, it's just stuff you can't watch with your kids anymore. And I know I'm like starting to turn into an old man by saying these kids with their rock and roll, but but it is. It's just sort of sad that, you know, you can't be an actor anymore without having to, you know, have that fear, so be it, in the back of your head, like, oh, what if I have to do this or that?
You know, did you feel pressured having to do the nude scene in The Delinquents? Or
no, you know, in fact, we had there's a few other nude scenes that were cut, and it was actually very, you know, all from the back, and mm-hmm. again, it was like such ladies and gentlemen on that set. So like when you had to do something like that, but there was a scene where. There was a scene where I get crabs, which was cut because we go to Singapore or something like that. Me and the bosun, and I get crabs, and I get like this big insect repellent can, and there's me like alone in these showers, just standing there naked, spraying this thing on my junk, and that was cut. But it was so funny when I walked out or onto the set to shoot that, I looked around and I go, you're kidding me. It was all women. Like, no guys were there. And it was a girl behind the camera and a girl, you know, directing. It's okay. What's going on here? But it was funny. And like back then, you could kind of, you know, you could kind of have a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
But it is, it, you know, it's not like the most comfortable thing in the world to do nude scenes. So you do, you know, like I said, fortunately, I think maybe because it was Australian, they were very, you know, I don't want to say proper about it, but everyone was very respectful of the whole process. Mm-hmm. And that's probably mm-hmm. based on how great Chris Thompson was, the director, you know, mm-hmm. who set the tone for that. And I think he knew that, you know, Kylie was somebody who had to be handled very delicately also, you know, who mm-hmm. I guess, you know, like me, hadn't done nude scenes or sex scenes or whatever. So it just had to be done, you know, you had to kind of choreograph it. Which they kind of do now, you know, with mm-hmm. these intimacy coaches and whatever. We didn't have that. We just kind of said, okay, at some point, you know, move your hand to this area and we'll have a camera here and that. And so you're like, okay. But you just, you know, you really respected each other. It wasn't like, ready, set, get them, you know.
Yeah.
you know, you were just, you were actors and you cared about, like, what you were putting out on film. And you also cared about, you know, your co-star as well and their comfort.
Yeah. So another giant project that you did in your career was the 1990 TV show Ferris Bueller, based on the iconic John Hughes film, where you co-starred beside Jennifer Aniston. Did you have any worries about stepping into the shoes of such an iconic character?
No, you know, sadly I didn't, you know, that's one of those things where they say, hey, Charlie, and I think I was like 24 at the time. Hey, Charlie, here's a lot of money to do something really bad. And you go, okay. And then that's pretty much the last project you do with that agent.
So at the time, you felt like you were doing something not great.
It's so funny. Like the pilot wasn't horrible, and it was funny, it had like good people involved. John Macias, who was the creator, had done Saint Elsewhere. He, you know, so you had people like with a good track record. We did the pilot, and then once the script started coming in and what it turned into, it just wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. And there was another show called Parker Stevens Can't Lose, I think, something like that.
Lewis?
Yeah. And that, you know, they got it right. That, you know, because theirs was edgy and theirs was more, you know, ours was a show that could have been called The Buellers. And, you know, it just, I don't know. I don't think that people were offended by like, oh, how dare you be, you know, Ferris Bueller or whatever. Because, you know, that's something that's happened forever. It wasn't the first time a TV series happened because of a movie, MASH, you know, I mean, The Odd Couple. You go down the line, there's a ton of TV shows that were based on movies. It just, like I said, it wasn't very good.
So in the pilot episode, in the opening scene, you actually take a standee of Matthew Broderick out of your closet.
Cut his head off,
Cut his head off with a chainsaw. Like, was that approved by Broderick? Or did he have any
because he has no rights to it. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, if someone wants to cut my head off from, you know, 18 again, I don't have any legal claim to that. You know what I mean? It just is what it is. I've never even met Matthew. We have mutual friends, but I don't even think he knew that there was a series called Ferris Bueller, nor would he care at this point. I think John Hughes actually approved of everything, you know, because he had to be a part of it as well. And so I think he had kind of signed off, basically saying, yeah, you can do this, this or that, whatever, with my characters. I think, you know, we were probably limited to some degree. I don't know. But again, you know, when you're like a 20 something year old kid and they're like, here's a bunch of money, cut off that head. Okay.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it is actually like watching that pilot. It is actually a bit ahead of its time in terms of how meta it is. I think that's a much more common thing now, but
no, you're right. You're right. And here's the thing. But the pilot, and it was like one of the most viewed pilots of all time. It like the ratings for that thing were through the roof. But then when it went to series, it was like, it just slowly went away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just kind of got lost in the 30s and the 40s and then the ratings, whatever. And, you know, it was probably just too expensive of a show to do another series. Another season, we probably could have, but again, I think it would have taken a lot of extra money on the part of NBC and whoever else, Paramount, to keep this thing afloat, and it probably just wasn't worth it. But I had fun, you know. I have fun doing everything, Paul, to be honest with you. You know, I don't care. I'm happy to be alive. Because I know I could be digging holes for a living. I've known that since I'm 16, so I'm okay. But like I said, I had fun, met great people. I always try to, like, in fact, the guy who played Rooney, the principal, Richard Reilly is his name. I've done countless shows with him to this point, and plays, and he's somebody who's in my life that I love. There's some really great things that have happened because of that. But, you know, again, I don't think in hindsight, I never really had a lot of ambition. I think I just kind of went from one project to the next thinking, okay, this is money. This is a job. Because to me, life is just working. It's having a job. And I love having a job. And I love working. And back then, I think the money kind of made me more excited than it should have. You go, wow, they want to pay me that for this? Okay. But
yeah, I saw your Jay Leno interview when you were promoting Ferris Bueller, and you were pretty much just talking about your paycheck.
Yeah, because it's crazy. I mean, yeah, I know that. And at that point, like, I was getting as much as Roseanne was getting for her show. And I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. It only lasted one season. But still, but it is. It's pretty stupid that they just, you know, because I always just thought I would go to college. I would major in musical theater. And after I graduate, I'll just get a small apartment in New York and I'll audition for plays. Every now and then I'll be in one. And that's my life. That's as high as I set that bar. And then, like I said, I auditioned for 18 again. I got stuff, and it just kind of kept going. So, you know, it just is what it is.
So that part of your life where you're starring on like a teen-centered primetime TV show, you're doing all these like press tours. I saw you getting interviewed by Will Smith and Jay Leno.
Well, no, that wasn't, you know, the funny thing is the thing that you saw with Will Smith was he and I, because he was doing Fresh Prince, which was the same year as Ferris Bueller. So they were the 8 to 8:30, we were the 8:30 to 9. And they had Will and I host, it was called Friday Night Videos. So we're sitting together, and that's what we had done. We hosted a video show together.
Oh, cool. So you're doing all that kind of stuff. You're doing photo spreads for like Teen Beat magazine. I saw you were on the cover of the magazine with the headline, vote for your fave rude boy at Corky Nemac versus Charlie Schlatter.
Wow.
Like, what is it like being part of that machine?
Honestly, I don't know, because I blinked and I missed it. That's really all I could tell. I mean, every now and then you'd have like some buddy from New Jersey call you, Schlatter, I saw this thing called Schlatter Mania. What the hell is that, you little weasel? You know, I don't know, man. I'm just trying to get some pizza in this town. I don't know. I try not to give it much credibility, and maybe I played it wrong. I don't know. Maybe I should have, but it just, you know, to me, it was just, I don't know, just side noise. You know, I just always tried to focus on just finding a good project and finding, you know, then you get to a point where it's like, okay, you got to stop doing garbage. You got to try and find some stuff that's good. And then, you know, the Diagnosis Murder thing came along, and just to do that for as many years as I did with Dick Van Dyke, that was just a masterclass in acting, you know, for however many years I was on that show. Just working with someone like that was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next question, actually, because, like, growing up, my two major staples in my house were Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Mary Poppins. Like,
oh yeah,
Dick Van Dyke was a constant presence in my life. And then obviously when Diagnosis Murder came out, it was like family viewing for us. We'd definitely watch that every Friday night, whatever it was on TV. I'm guessing it would have been amazing working opposite Dick Van Dyke.
It was, you know, it was like working with the Easter Bunny every day. I mean, just something magical about the guy. And, you know, again, there'd be times where you just sit next to him and you're thinking, oh, my God, I'm sitting here talking to Dick Van Dyke and he's talking to me and we're friends. It was just, it's weird, you know, because like you said, you grew up on Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Mary Poppins, but. Yeah, when you're just sitting there for a while with the guy, you think, it was surreal. Even after 6 or 7 years of doing it, you were still like, this is really weird. but he was honestly just the best. You know what I love about guys like Dick Van Dyke and George Burns is they never sit you down as the younger man to say, okay, Paul, this is how you need to do things. Never. Those guys are so great. You just sit back, and if you're a human being, you can't help but look at them and learn from just the way they conduct themselves, the way they approach the business, the way they're the first ones on the set, last ones to leave. They never complain. They know their lines. They hit their marks. And, you know, and it really wasn't until then. I always really tried to be a professional about everything, but it really wasn't until that Diagnosis Murder that I think I developed a really healthy work habit, and I think a lot of that is because of Dick, and because you had all these co-stars would come in too, people like Bryan Cranston and Cloris Leachman, and just great actors. And if you knew you were doing a couple scenes with them, you wanted to be at the top of your game, you know what I mean? You wanted to provide an environment for these people in your home that they were going to be comfortable in. So I really tried to learn that way, but you you learn that you could be happy in your 70s, 80s, and 90s still doing this, which is encouraging too, to say, oh, I don't need to retire. You could still find joy in this business at the age of 80 years old, you know?
Yeah. You could even remake 18 again when you're 81.
I could possibly in like, you know, 50 years or so.
So you've become a prolific voice actor in some huge animated series and video games, voicing characters like The Flash and Kim Batowski. Do you think you're developing a preference for voiceover over live action projects?
I try to make a long story not eternity. Years and years ago, I got leukemia, and so, but I had already been doing a few cartoons. I already had a voice career. I had a manager that was great, had a voiceover agent that was great. had an on-camera theatrical agent, they're called, the people who book me or, you know, help me to find work on TV, movies, whatever. I basically had a lunch, I'll make a long, like I said, had a lunch with the agents on a Monday after I had been going through treatments for cancer. Basically told them on a Monday, hey, by the way, I have cancer. But I'm good. I'm going through treatments. I'm getting healthier. The hair is coming back, all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. Oh, that's really great, Charlie. Well, good. You look really good. Great. Okay. See you soon. Mm-hmm. And I shit you not, Paul, I think it was like 2 days later when I get the call saying, hey, listen, Charlie, we're kind of thinning the herd over here at the agency. And unfortunately, we're not going to pick up your contract. I said, okay, that's really great. Bye. And it was at that moment that I thought, okay, I'm just going to do theater in little theaters in LA. I'm going to, you know, kind of get lost in my voice career. And that's what I do, because that was the community that really said, hey, it's okay, dude, if you have cancer or not, we're going to hire you. We're still going to work with you. So I owe so much to this community, and I just love it. I love, mm-hmm. It's so incestuous. I mean, I work with like the same 10 freaking actors on every cartoon, no matter what. And every now and then I pop up in like For All Mankind or Feud or something. I pop up in stuff on camera, but now it's just cause, oh, I really like that director. I really like that writer. I really like that show. And, you know, Shameless. I love the show Shameless. I want to be in that. And so I got in that. But I just, you know, I don't have that young energy to say, okay, I gotta be in this movie and that movie and worry about a career. I'm so done like thinking about a career. I care about just working and doing jobs that now are fulfilling. I love teaching. But for the most part, yeah, I really like the cartoons. You know, I sit here in my little booth and we have Zoom meetings and I make my fart noises with a bunch of other adults, and it's really great. So I'm super lucky that way. So I do kind of choose that. I still look for things, like I said, on camera. I just don't like lose sleep over it. I'm so not emotionally, I'm just not emotionally attached to work. I like to work, but I don't, it's not like, when you're younger and you go, I really got to get that role. I got to get that role. You know, there are some things that I'd still love to do and plays I would love. Like there are plays I would love, love, love to do. But but again, you know, to me, I've got a family. I've got a wife. I've got kids. I've got so many like blessings in my life that theatrical stuff is just, it's sadly, not sadly, but just it takes a back seat to anything else right now.
So are there any projects in your filmography that you feel are underseen or that you would love for people to have discovered?
Nah. In a word, nah. I can say there've been a couple cartoons I've done that I really like. There was a series called Pet Alien that I thought was brilliant, and it was myself with three other actors, and we did all the voices for all these crazy characters. And it was canceled for just, you know, bad politics, you know, people not making the right deals, and well, if we can't get this money, we're taking our marbles and we're going home, kind of that stuff. So a show just folded for no reason. But there was that thing that I really liked, and then there was a show that I had done. I did a pilot, and we did, I think we were on our fourth episode when they pulled the plug. I think that might have been a Paramount or TriStar Pictures, or I don't know. It was called Circus, and it was a funny little show. It was by some of the people who did Married with Children. Created this thing. It was with Roger Reese. I don't know if you know who he is, the British actor who did Nicholas Nickleby. He's a Tony Award winning guy. He was also on Cheers forever. Great, like, I mean, so well respected British actor. And anyway, it was about this kid, me, who runs away from his family to join a circus to become a clown. And he's a horrible clown, but he wants to be with his hero, Kelso. the clown, who's like a raging, angry alcoholic. And the whole thing just takes place, you know, in a circus tent. We had, you know, little people, we had bearded women, we had everything. And it was some of the funniest damn writing I've ever, like, said in my life. And unfortunately, they pulled the plug on us because our producer was in a fight with someone else at the studio. There's like, I don't want to say there's books written about it, but there's many articles written about the pilot circus and why it ended and stuff like that. But yeah, but that was so one that, that's one that I wish that kind of did something. You know, I've done a lot of other pilots where I go, yeah, this ain't going anywhere. And they don't.
So can you find circus anywhere, or is it lost to the ages?
I couldn't. Maybe you probably could. If something exists, it's out there. You know, I don't have the technical know-how or the time in the day to look for it. Because even if I found it, what would I do with it? I'd watch it again. So I don't know. And I rarely watch anything that I'm in. I've been like that almost my whole career. It's very rare that I will watch something that I'm in.
So do you have any exciting projects coming up or anything that you're currently working on?
I have. I'm in a show right now called Big Nate, which is a Nickelodeon cartoon, which is I think it's like the number one streaming show on Paramount Plus TV. So that's happening. I play Chad in that, this little 11-year-old fat redheaded kid.
Yeah, my nephew reads the Big Nate book, so I'm sure he watches the show as well.
It's such a great series. It's I mean, the comic book series, it's really great. And so, yeah, it's based on that. I have another show right now that I'm doing with Jane Lynch and Beanie Feldstein called Harriet the Spy, and that's on Apple Plus TV. And then I just started recording a new series for Mattel called Hot Wheels. You know the cars? Mm. So yeah. I'm a talking car, and I think that one's going to be really, really good. And I will say, like, I do. I love doing cartoons, and I love the fact that I'm in this cast with Big Nate where all the characters, we were able to read a script for a bunch of fourth graders a week ago. And, you know, to me, like, that's the stuff that's really fulfilling about a career and being able to do stuff with any amount of, you know, quote unquote celebrity. It's nice when you could just kind of give back like that. I find that so fulfilling, as opposed to someone walking down the street going, "Yo, Ferris, what's up, man?" You know, okay, yeah. You know, but now that you could do stuff, and even like Diagnosis Murder, a lot of my fan base and people that write to me who actually like write handwritten letters are 80 years old, 90 years old. So they're in the kind of the twilight years. And yeah. And I'm able to kind of reach out and write back to them and send them pictures and call or whatever they, you know, request. I try to honor like all those requests because it's so cute. They're like a million years old and they remember you. And hey, Dr. Jesse, I have acute angina. You just have to abide. So that, like I said, Paul, that's like one of the nicest parts of what we do, you know, just sharing.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. And like, you know, obviously agreeing to do shows like this, you know, we're not giant and we really do appreciate the fact that you're taking the time out of your day to come.
Always,
to us,
listen, so. You know, I hate that. I hate when people, I don't know. I don't know if I have time to do that today. What am I? You know, it's like, hey, you want to sit with someone for an hour and talk to them about something that you really love that you could contribute to. I'll do that any day of the week. You know, I mean, I'm not going to do it every day of the week, Paul, so don't get any ideas. But listen, if someone calls you and says, hey, I've got this podcast about something as crazy as body swapping, you know, it's like, all right, sign me up. I'm in. You know what I mean? I'll do it. I don't care.
Well, we really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much. Who's the next soul switcher in your lined up for you? Do you have one yet?
As in next interview or our next movie that we're going to be covering?
Yeah, like the next interview.
I haven't lined up any interviews, but if you know of any, like if you can reach out to Kurt Cameron, let us know.
I'll see if I could send you something, and, but you didn't get it from me.
But yeah, it's been a true pleasure and honor to speak to you today. Really appreciate it. So what's the best way for our listeners to keep track of your upcoming projects and to kind of see you online?
I honestly, Paul, I suck. I don't advertise a lot of stuff, but I do. I'm on Instagram. Just you look for Charlie Schlatter and you'll see my face. It pops up and that is me. And then, you know, believe it or not, like just on Facebook, I'm pretty good at like reaching out, and I put out stuff like, oh, I'm on an episode of whatever. I put it out there. Mm-hmm. I'm on Twitter. I don't think I've looked at that account in years because I just hate it. Every time I go on Twitter, everyone's just mean, you know. I'm just trying to catch some Giants scores. And that's about it. But yeah, I think mostly like Instagram is probably like the easiest place, because every now and then I'll put out, oh, my band is playing here, or well, I'm doing this or that, you know. But I hate all that self-promotion stuff. I'm really like, I'm horrible at it. Are you good at it? Are you good at promoting the show and stuff?
You know, we have an Instagram that I kind of post every time we do any episode, but
good.
Yeah, I struggle with it. I do struggle with it as well.
Maybe, you know, I don't know. Maybe I should get it. And, you know, my daughters, like they're, I guess what's called like influencers, and, you know, they get all this free crap in the mail. It's like, if you're just like a pretty white girl in a bathing suit, you're going to get free stuff. And that's them. They just, you know, they have jobs, but they also just get like free clothing all the time. And I go, hey, I'll take that hoodie. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to work it, but maybe it's better off I don't know how to work it, you know?
Well, you seem to be doing fine without it. Like, honestly, if you can live your life and you don't need it, I think that's a positive.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also just, you know, living with some sort of anonymity too, it's nice, because the people who do recognize me are usually very kind, but a lot of times people don't. And that's like, it's a blessing. I really don't want fame. You know what I mean? In that sense, I love success and I like to be successful at things that I love doing. Don't get me wrong, but I really don't want to be that guy that, you know, you're in traffic and they go, hey, Paul, I recognize you from, you know, it's like, oh no, I just want to be a sheep. I really do.
Yeah. And I bet like you probably have known a lot of very famous people and you can see firsthand of what it can do to them and what their lives are like. So you probably have a deeper appreciation than most.
And I see what it could turn them into as well, you know, and it's usually not for the better. You know what I mean? I don't know a lot of people who get famous and then get better, become a better person because of it. And myself as well. I don't think I was at the best Charlie I could be when I was in my early 20s and a lot of people knew who I was. I don't think that guy is somebody that, you know, I'd want to hang out with right now. I like Charlie from like 35 on, you know. I like that guy.
Well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thanks,
buddy. And if you ever want to come back, just let us know. If you want to review someone else's Body Swap movie, you're more than welcome.
I'll sit and review with you. Okay.
Yeah. So that's it for another episode of the Swapcast podcast, and we'll hear from you next time.
Thanks, buddy.
The Swapcast podcast is recorded in Adelaide, Australia. It's hosted by Paul Mitzi and edited by Brendan Levi and Paul Mitzi. Our theme song was written and performed by John Marco of Two Creative, featuring Lucy Thomas, and recorded at Browntown Studios. Our music bumpers were created by Reggie Parker. Contact him on parkerregmusic@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.